When Mary Green and her husband adopted their son Peter from a Russian orphanage at the age of three, the boy was severely damaged. His mood swung from oddly passive to violent. He seemed almost feral, unable to build an attachment to his parents, and he suffered severe developmental delays. After dozens of consultations, doctors finally concluded that Peter was suffering from multiple disabilities, including the one that Mary had feared most, fetal alcohol syndrome. In this hour of midday, a Maryland mother tells of being the adoptive parent to a child with severe disabilities and searching for answers for her damaged little boy. First, the news. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Our second hour today. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us. Adoption can be an emotional roller coaster for parents. The highs of meeting what seems to be the perfect son or daughter, the lows of having arrangements fall through. And for parents who are able to bring a child home, sometimes they face challenges they never expected. Mary Green and her husband, Pat, adopted their son, Peter, from a Russian orphanage at the age of three. There seemed to be something quite not quite normal about Peter, and Mary and Pat soon discovered why. His moods swung between oddly passive and violent. Peter seemed to be unable to build an attachment to his parents, and he suffered severe developmental delays. After dozens of consultations, doctors finally concluded that Peter was suffering from multiple disabilities, including the one that Mary had feared most, fetal alcohol syndrome. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates that fetal alcohol spectrum disorders may affect between 2 and 5% of the population in the United States and in Western Europe, but this disorder has not been studied widely. Children diagnosed with fetal alcohol syndrome may suffer from memory and speech problems, delayed motor skill development, hyperactivity, and other problems. In this hour, we're going to hear from Mary Green, a lawyer and a writer and author of a memoir on this, on her own story, a memoir, obviously, called When Rain Hurts. That's the title. I'll tell you about the title. Well, Mary will tell us about that title in a moment. When Rain Hurts, An Adoptive Mother's Journey with Fetal Alcohol Syndrome, published by Renhen Press. Is that right, Mary?
Yes,
it's Renhen Press. And Mary lives here in Maryland. She's been here in Maryland a couple of years now. She's an environmental attorney and a writer, as I said, and blogs on this subject. So anyway, welcome to Midday, Mary. It's nice to meet you.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you for having me here.
The title, When Rain Hurts, comes from your son, Peter, who actually said to you one time, or maybe multiple times, when he was small, that rain hurts. Do you remember the first time you heard him say that?
I do. We were walking someplace, and obviously it was raining outside, although very, very lightly. He was acting as though grenades were going off, dodging, dipping, grunting. And I had, at that point, he was about 6 or 7, learned not to ask him why questions. They never yielded a satisfying answer. But I did anyway. I said, Peter, why are you doing that? And he looked at me, and he didn't often have language to respond appropriately at that point. But he looked at me, and he said, Mama, rain hurts, Peter. Hmm. And that was a real epiphany for me. I understood, really, at that moment, in a crystallized way, that the world was assaulting him everywhere he went, that he had so many sensory issues that a little bit of rain was causing him significant distress. And to me, it was very important because I understood my son for the first time, I think, at that moment.
He was 5 at that time?
He was 5 or 6.
Yeah. I want you to go back for us, Mary, to 2002, 2003, 2004, that period of your life. Talk about that, would you, a little bit? Because that's sort of where our story begins. Where were you in life? What was your life like then?
Well, my husband and I were married. We were living in New York City on the Upper West Side. He is a fiction editor. I was working as an enforcement attorney for the Environmental Protection Agency. And we had a nice little life. We lived in the city, and we were fortunate enough to be able to purchase a weekend home in the mid-central Hudson Valley, which is beautiful if you know it. And we would go up there on weekends, and then we'd come back to the city and do city things during the week. And it was a lovely little existence.
And no children?
No children, although we wanted them. So we had done the ordinary steps to form a family and then turned to medical steps. And when, after a series of miscarriages, we decided to pursue adoption. We had always talked about it anyway. We thought maybe if we'd had a birth child, we would also adopt a second child. So it was easy for us. It wasn't a big thing that we had to go through emotionally.
What got you and Pat to thinking about Russia, adopting a child from Russia?
Well, that's where it gets a little bit more complicated. My husband had been married before, and they had three children, and he had lost two sons in the course of that marriage. They had a baby that died and a 12-year-old hit by a car on his bicycle. So they had just gone through hell and back. And one of the things that was important to me, much more than to him, was to be able, since we were in the position of adopting and you could make those choices, that I wanted to give him a son. I wanted him to have that experience. We wanted to adopt two kids. So that eliminated a lot of the Asian countries for us because boys simply aren't available. So we looked at Russia for that reason. Another reason we looked at Russia, and again, this primarily stemmed from me, is that I liked the idea at the time of not having to wear our adoption status on our sleeves. In other words, these kids would look enough like we did that we would pass in the mall and the shopping center, that we could bring it up when we wanted to or when our children wanted to, but we didn't have to wear it on our sleeve. And one of the things that I say in my book is that it's a little ironic because, A, I'm very open about our kids' adoptions and encourage our children to be too, and so is my husband, and proud of that, of our status as an adoptive family. And B, you know, especially when Peter was younger, some of his behaviors in public were just extraordinary. And people would look at me as, why can't you do anything about your child? So it's almost like I traded the appearance of normalcy for perhaps what could have been actual normalcy.
Now, you didn't get to Peter right away. There were two other children first. I guess we should talk about this. Ben and Sophie, right?
That's correct. We had received a referral from our adoption agency. There were actually a few babies that through the adoption pediatrician we were consulting with had suggested that we turn down because she understood, based on discussions with us, that we weren't prepared to take on special needs, not knowingly. I mean, you always have a risk of not knowing what your children are going to face down the road. That's true whether biological or adopted.
Right.
But that we didn't think that we were the ones that were most capable of taking this on affirmatively. So in getting a couple referrals from the agency that were from Russia, this doctor, Dr. Aronson, told us that the risks were high and we should consider passing on them, which we did.
On those two children?
On a couple babies,
now,
yes.
How did Dr. Aronson was what, a pediatric, a pediatrician, adoption
That's
pediatrician?
That's correct.
How did she know that?
Well, the agency obtains from the orphanages in Russia what are called referrals, and they usually consist of a brief medical report, some photographs, and if you're lucky, a video. And then you send, and those like us who take advantage of those services send those materials on to someone like Dr. Aronson, who takes a look at them and make some judgments based upon what he or she sees. You can tell a lot in a video, developmental progress. Pictures are very useful to screen for fetal alcohol syndrome if they're taken correctly because they can be fed into a computer program that analyzes the face for features that suggest the child is alcohol exposed.
Would you take a moment here and explain that to our listeners? What physical feature develops that is a giveaway for fetal alcohol syndrome?
Well, there are certain hallmarks, but it's important to keep in mind that the absence of them doesn't mean the child isn't alcohol exposed. The presence of them means that alcohol was ingested during a certain period of the pregnancy.
Can you describe one?
But some of those features are a lack of philtrum. That is the ribbon of flesh between the nose and the lip. It was described to me as that area that men hate to shave.
Yeah. What about it?
Well, those are where, in fetal development, that is where the two halves of the brain come together, and it's almost like a seam. That's why we have this mark of symmetry in our faces. Mm-hmm. It's where everything comes together. And the lack of it is an indication that brain development did not occur normally. The other thing that occurs, I'm not a doctor. This is my lay
understanding. Yeah, right.
One of the other main features is a thin upper lip that goes along with that lack of philtrum.
What had alerted you to the possibility of fetal alcohol syndrome? Is it because it was Russia?
Yes.
And Dr. Aronson had warned you about that.
Yes, we had attended some pre-adoption classes, so I had read as much as I could about it at the time.
Okay, so we understand then. An orphanage in Russia, if they have doctors on staff, I assume maybe they have doctors on staff, maybe I shouldn't assume that. Do they report to your agency or to you that there's a possibility that the children that you're seeing either in videos or photographs have this?
It may occur. It certainly doesn't occur often. Russians don't recognize fetal alcohol syndrome as a disorder. They generally do not accept that alcohol can cause brain damage to a developing fetus.
Okay, back to the story of the two children then. Ben and Sophie, I'm correct in using those names, right? That's what their names were. There were two, a boy and a girl, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so you and Pat, your husband, you go to Russia. This is August 2004 now. So you go there, and what's the intent? Is the intent to adopt those two?
Well, we had gone to meet a baby that we were planning to name Ben. And in that process, we said, because we were crazy, why don't we bring two children home at once, and then we will complete our family, and we don't have to go through this again.
I see. Okay.
My husband is 17 years older than I am, so that was always on my mind. So that's why we went there, to hopefully meet our two children. Well, we got there and we went to the orphanage and we were told that there was no child, by the name of Ben. I don't recall his full Russian name. And that was alarming, of course, and it took a little effort on our part, and I did have to go into sort of prosecutorial mode to find out where this child was located. But we eventually located him in a hospital about a mile down the road from this town. It turns out that he had been there since birth and had never left a day in his life. He was a little over 1 year old, and he was in very, very bad shape. The information they had sent to us about him was incorrect. It was not. It would no way resemble this child. It was,
He was not a healthy baby.
He was not a healthy baby, and the measurements, the weight, the length, none of those things matched.
Do you know what was wrong with him?
I don't know what was wrong with him. I suspect that he did have FAS.
Okay. So what did you and Pat decide to do in that situation?
Well, we were frantic to get in touch with our adoption pediatrician, who we did reach eventually. We took a lot of measurements. We spent a lot of time negotiating a review of the child's medical records, which was very difficult to obtain, but we did.
When you say measurements, actually measured the child's body?
Well, one of the things you do is in addition to some facial features, height and weight and head circumference are also significant indicators of alcohol exposure. So it was very important to get those things. And we also met Sophie, who was at the orphanage and who we did end up adopting. And, of course, she's our daughter today.
Now, how old was Sophie at that time, August 2004?
She had just turned two. Her birthday's in July.
So she was two. And with the baby Ben in the hospital, what was your decision was not to adopt that child?
Well, we left Biro Bijan, which is the region we adopted from, and traveled back to Moscow. And then we spent a couple of days in St. Petersburg only because the trip had already been planned. I mean, we weren't much in the mood for travel at that point. Russia requires two trips, so this was the trip just to meet the children. We weren't bringing them home. So in St. Petersburg, we got in touch with Dr. Aronson, and she basically helped us make the decision that this was not something that we could take on. She had said that we could heal his body. He also couldn't eat. He wasn't feeding. He was very, very thin. But she said that we could not fix his brain. We also consulted another. We got a second opinion on that from a very kind man named Dr. Dana Johnson. And he made the same recommendation.
So before we take our first break here, Mary, how did you get to Peter?
Well, when we returned to the States, of course, we were upset with our adoption agency because they sent us halfway around the world with not even knowing where this child was. And we said that we wanted, when we returned to adopt Sophie, to meet another child that was healthy or at least had the indications of being healthy on paper and have the opportunity to adopt him when we went back.
And that's when we'll meet Peter after this short break. Mary Evelyn Green is our guest. Her book, her memoir about this experience is called When Rain Hurts, An Adoptive Mother's Journey with Fetal Alcohol Syndrome, published by Red Hen Press, not Ren Hen Press, Red Hen Press. So we'll take a short break, Mary. We'll come back and talk and meet Peter for the first time.
Sounds good.
Welcome back to Midday, spending some time this hour with Mary Green, who is an attorney and a writer and a mom who lives here in Maryland. She's written a memoir about her experience in adapting a boy from Russia, from a Russian orphanage at the age of three. His name is Peter. The name of the book, the memoir, is When Rain Hurts, An Adoptive Mother's Journey with Fetal Alcohol Syndrome. So you were on the alert for fetal alcohol syndrome when you and your husband, Pat, went about this. I just want to back up for a moment. The little baby Ben that you were describing, that you decided not to adopt. Subsequently, you found out that he was adopted by an American family?
That's right. I did find that out through the adoption community.
So you made another trip to Russia to bring Sophie home, and you were introduced to this little boy named Peter.
That's correct.
Can you tell us about that, Mary? Tell us about your first encounter with Peter. Where'd you meet him?
Well, we were in the sort of receiving room at the orphanage, which is a big, bright room with toys all over the place. I think it's, you know, the equivalent of a living room in somebody's home. And there were big doors on either end of the room. And Sophie came through one door. And remember, we had met her on our first trip.
Right.
And somebody else brought Peter in on the other door. And so, you know, that was kind of exciting. We had these two toddlers sort of.
Can you describe Sophie for us at that age and then describe Peter?
Well, she was tiny, very underweight, blonde, but with wispy, thin hair. She also had a obvious resilience and spunk about her. She was a very funny kid. She made the caregivers in the orphanage laugh. They were clearly very, very fond of her. They cried when we left. So she was a very, very special child.
And what about Peter? What did he look like the first time you saw him?
Well, he was beautiful. He is an extraordinarily beautiful child. He could probably model if we could get him to follow directions better. So he was beautiful. He was very small, much smaller than I think I realized. We ended up buying him 9-month-old clothes, for instance.
And he was three.
Almost three and a half.
Wow.
So he was tiny.
Wow.
He was bright-eyed. He was very interested in my husband. He was not interested in me at all.
Hmm. What was the orphanage like?
It was grim. It was stark. The grounds were overgrown. There was not really any playground equipment. There had been some swings, but they weren't, the actual swings weren't there anymore, that kind of thing. The women there, I think, were doing the absolute best that they could with almost nothing. You know, they told us that they would bring food and vegetables from their own gardens to try to supplement the kids' diets. It was sad. It was impoverished. But I think that people there were genuinely doing the best that they could.
Was the orphanage run by a church, a religious group, the state? Do you know who?
It's run by the state.
Run by the state. Did you get a vibe from the people who worked there about how they felt about Americans adopting Russian children? Did they care who adopted the children? Did you get any sense of that?
Well, we had a translator who worked with American families and specifically with this one orphanage. So I think that the people who worked in the orphanage as well as our translator were very invested in this process. They knew these kids were getting out. They knew they had no chance if they stayed in. So I think there was a very palpable feeling of hope and exuberance and good fortune.
It was the year 2004 or 2005 now on this second trip.
It was, we went back in October 2004.
2004, okay. A couple of months after the first trip. You say, neither the rhythm of Peter's voice nor his body language was normal. But at the time, I was more rattled by his reactions, which were robotic, repetitive, and obsessive. And this is from your first encounters with him.
That is true. Today, knowing much more than I knew then, I would say that he appeared autistic. He was very stiff and robotic and acted like a wooden, like a little wooden soldier.
Hmm. But he interacted more with your husband, Pat, than with you at first.
He did, and he was very focused on a book that my husband had and was interested in that and some of the other toys that they bring out when prospective parents are meeting children in these orphanages.
Mary, those observations you made, you say it kind of slowed you down a little bit, made you a little bit concerned. You wondered whether you could slow down the adoption process at that point. Did you?
It made me very concerned. I felt there was something wrong. I also felt extremely guilty about acting on that concern. Lots of people were telling us that he was fine, that he would be fine. I certainly wanted him to be fine. In the end, we could have stopped it. My husband wasn't where I was. That would have been very, very difficult.
It would have been difficult for him?
It would have been difficult for him, and it would have been difficult for our relationship, I think. I think it was strong enough we could have gotten past it, but that was weighing on my mind pretty heavily, too, because he was more invested in the idea that Peter was okay. I had more concerns than he did.
I can imagine that this was an awkward situation. Here you are, you've flown over, you made your second trip, you're in the orphanage, you meet the little boy, you're observing him, you're having questions, and when do you have the conversation about, whoa, can we slow this down? It must have been very awkward.
Well, we had a lot of difficult conversations, mostly in the middle of the night mm-hmm. in Russia about this. But in the end, we decided that we would bring him home and we would hope for the best and deal with what came as it came.
Did you get any push from the orphanage about being there and, you know, you can't leave empty-handed, please take this child? Was there pressure, I guess I'm asking?
Well, we actually received quite a lot of pressure, but it was less from the orphanage and more from our adoption agency. They did caution us that we could have been jeopardizing our adoption with our daughter, that the court might not take kindly on this. And that many people were lining up to adopt Sophie, and they put quite a lot of pressure on us, which seems absurd now when I look back on it. They weren't going to undo these adoptions. But it felt as legitimate extra pressure at the time.
Do you remember looking very closely at Peter, the little boy that you were going to adopt, looking very closely at the, is it the philtrum again, that the space between the lip and the nose?
Yes.
Did you look very closely at that?
I did. His philtrum is not well formed. Unfortunately, we had sent a series of different photographs to Dr. Aronson to review, and none of them were taken. They need to be taken in a certain perspective, three-quarters profile, front and front on, without the child smiling. They were not quite right for the computer program that's used. In addition, the agency, for whatever reason, sent us a series of pictures that we are now quite convinced weren't Peter. They don't look like him, and it looks, the pictures that we have, one of which is in the book, appears to be an older child. Peter looked much younger when we met him, so I don't, my husband and I can't understand how that could have been Peter.
Is that agency Russian or American?
American.
Mary Evelyn Green is our guest on Midday here on WYPR. Her book is When Rain Hurts, An Adoptive Mother's Journey with Fetal Alcohol Syndrome. The word feral, I saw the word feral on the back of your book. Is that an accurate word for what you came to see in Peter's behavior?
Yes. It wasn't obvious at first. And within a few months of him being home, maybe because he became more relaxed, maybe because he didn't realize we weren't going to hurt him, but his behaviors blossomed almost all at once. And it was quite unmanageable.
I think this is the place in the show where you describe what that was like for you, what you observed, what he did to make you use that word.
Well, he would do things like smear feces all over himself. He would spit on us. He would bite. He would have these rages. He pulled. We lived in a 1733 house at the time that still had some old wallpaper in it. He would pull the wallpaper from the walls, destroy the walls. He would take doorknobs off. He would stuff things in toilets. He would vomit at the dinner table all over his food. He would make himself vomit. We could see him doing this. And the list just goes on and on and on.
Did any of this happen while you were traveling back to the United States with him, you and Pat and Sophie and Peter?
No. He was quite easy to travel with. He was very focused. Again, this is quasi-autistic behavior, but he was very focused on the radio in the airplane and pushing those buttons, and he just did that over and over for 30 hours, really.
It was a radio in the seat?
In the seat, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So did you talk to him?
Well, of course we tried to.
You tried to talk to him.
Yeah, he had very little language. We thought he really had very little Russian language, and he certainly didn't have much English language, so that's very difficult.
But that wild and destructive behavior you described that you saw in New York, you didn't see that during the travel home?
No, it started a few months after we were home. We didn't see it the first few months at home either.
Now, you heavily suspected fetal alcohol syndrome at the outset, even before you met Peter, when you were considering adopting other children, as you said. But you must have thought, well, we've got one here. We have fetal alcohol syndrome. I guess you wanted to know that answer right away.
We did. We took the kids after we had been home about a week. We were at our house upstate, and we took them into New York City to see Dr. Aronson to have her do physicals of them in person, not
right.
on paper.
Right.
And she did tell us then. She said time would tell, but he appeared to have FAS.
What did you learn about FAS?
Well, I had read a good deal beforehand, which is really what prompted me to write this book, because none of what I read prepared me for the reality of it, for living within the four corners of this disability. You know, what I call living and loving in the presence of this kind of brain damage. So I had learned that individuals with FAS have frontal lobe damage, they have executive dysfunction, which is that part of your brain that allows you to understand cause and effect, to control your impulses, to keep some focus. It has working memory. That's where working memory is located. It allows you to understand that what you do now is going to have consequences further in time. All of those things that really make us who we are in many ways is in that part of the brain.
So it became obvious. Well, I don't know if I don't want to jump ahead here, but when did it become obvious? It seems to me like this is kind of an easy diagnosis, but it doesn't sound like it was.
Well, it wasn't. I think part of it was that we were in a rural area. And I think part of it is that physicians don't to this day know what this disorder is. They don't recognize it. They weren't trained in it in medical school. It's not taught. My understanding, even today in 2014, in medical school curriculum. And I think there's a natural inclination to say, these kids need time. They're neglected. They're deprived. They were in an orphanage. They didn't have regular caregivers. They had a lot of strikes against them. They're in a new environment, new language. Everything's different. They need time. You need to be patient. You need to give them love. Time will heal this.
So it could be many factors, one of many factors for a Russian child.
Yes.
Is what you were told. Not necessarily fetal alcohol syndrome.
Correct.
But there was a conclusion made.
Yes.
And how long did that take, Mary?
Well, we had been working with Dr. Aronson, mostly on a long-distance basis, and she told us at some point when we said we can't do this anymore, we need real help, she said it was time for us to go see a colleague of hers in Northern Virginia, a neuropsychologist who specializes in these kids.
We're going to talk about that after this break, but I need one more question here before we go on. I'm trying to imagine you and your husband looking at each other at some point here and saying, what did we get ourselves into, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah,
I'm sure you had this conversation.
We have. Many times.
Did you have arguments about it?
No, we really didn't.
So you realize you're in this together?
I think so, yes.
You think so?
It's been a saving grace for us. We haven't had a lot of those arguments. We haven't turned on each other. I think we've been very careful of each other. And I think it saved our marriage, although we've certainly had our share of strain on our marriage. But I think that we have been very careful to look out for each other and be a united team rather than going in separate directions.
I know some people have sent the children back.
Yes.
A couple of cases made the news here in the United States a few years ago. Some parents are criticized for doing that, adoptive parents. What are your views on it?
Well, they're certainly more complicated now than they were before we entered our own journey. I could never condone that. I think there are other solutions, if you're referring to the woman who put the boy on the airplane.
Yeah, that was in 2010.
Yeah. From Tennessee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I understand the desperation and the sense of isolation and loneliness that perhaps this woman was feeling, especially since she was a single mother.
Yeah.
I think it was a horrible result, and I think it was the wrong thing to do. And you can't just abandon a child. But I understand the desperation that drives someone to make unfortunate choices.
In the case of you and your husband, Pat, that was never a question.
No, although people told us that we should consider it. More frequently than you might imagine.
Mary Evelyn Green is our guest in this hour of midday, talking about her memoir, When Rain Hurts, An Adoptive Mother's Journey with Fatal Alcohol Syndrome. So we'll take another break here, Mary, and come back and talk some more, okay?
Sure.
Lyrical playing to the works of Beethoven, Alexander Scriabin, and Modest Mussorgsky. Goucher College's Krausser Auditorium, Sunday, March 8th, 7 p.m. Tickets must be reserved. Goucher.edu/tickets. And support comes from Cecil County Office of Economic Development, Tourism, and Agriculture. Cecil County, with room to grow businesses and access to the Baltimore and Wilmington labor markets. Cecil County, 410-996-6292 or cecilbusiness.org. Stay tuned this afternoon at 2 for Here and Now with a look at net neutrality and the future of the Internet. That's at 2 o'clock right after midday. And coming our way later today...
Hey, Baltimore, I got some bad news. Those 100-year-old sewer pipes you've got, they're kind of becoming a problem.
It's like a time bomb. This old infrastructure, we know it's going to fail. The question is where and when.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. $1 trillion, that's how much we're all going to need to fix the pipes under our feet. That story next time on Marketplace from APM.
Marketplace at 6:30 this evening here on WYPR.
Welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks with Mary Green. Mary Evelyn Green, our guest in this hour of the show, who's an environmental attorney, works for the Environmental Integrity Project, right, in Washington, D.C.
That's correct.
You live now with your husband, Peter and Sophie, in Montgomery County. Mary's written a book about her son called When Rain Hurts, An Adoptive Mother's Journey with Fetal Alcohol Syndrome, When Rain Hurts, because Peter said to you, rain hurts Peter when he was 5 years old, and you came to understand something about how damaged he was with his own words, right? How did Dr. Federici help you? This is Ron Federici, a clinical neuropsychologist that you were referred to in Virginia, and he had had some experience with children from Eastern Europe, right, so from orphanages there.
Well, yes, to say he has some experience is a bit of an understatement.
Oh, yeah.
He adopted 7 or maybe 8
really?
Kids from Romanian orphanages,
wow.
He and his wife.
So how did he help you with Peter?
Well, he unraveled the ball of yarn, really, for us. We brought him in. We had already started Peter on some medication. He asked us to take him off of it. He wanted to see him... what his baseline was, and he did a series of neuropsychological tests on him. He did confirm, based on that testing, that all of his results were consistent with fetal alcohol exposure. He also told us that he was on the autism spectrum, and he told us what his specific learning disabilities were, which were many, many, many. He told us that he behaved as an abused child and that he had psychotic symptoms, which he said were the symptoms that worried him most. And this was a few months before Peter had turned 6. And at the time, my husband and I looked at each other like, what do you mean psychotic symptoms? And he said, well, some of his reactions and his responses to questions and the pictures that he drew show a real disconnect between with reality. And he said, that's very troubling to see in such a very young age. So we had that now to live with as well. But what he gave us was a real blueprint. You know, he's the first person that said, here it is, here's what's wrong with him, here is what you need to do to organize his brain, to get the chaos in his head to focus on you so that he will allow you to parent him, that he will allow you to externally organize his brain.
Can you give us a little piece of that? Like, what was the practical advice? What did he actually, Dr. Federici, send you home with?
Well, the very first practical advice he gave us was to do this month-long exercise, which I refer to as boot camp, which is basically trying to get the child to accept that you are his parents and that he needs to look to you to meet basic needs. So that what that means is that he asked us, and me in particular, to be within 3 to 5 feet of Peter at all times. And that to turn off all the televisions, to turn off the radios, to not leave the property of our house. Thank goodness we had 8 acres. We could at least go outside. To not have anybody over, to not go to work, and to not go to school.
To force him in your presence, to always be in your presence.
Yes, that he was doing what I was doing and I was doing what he was doing. And we divided the day into 15-minute increments.
And how did it go?
Well, it was the most difficult thing that I have ever done by far. And obviously, we are at a very desperate point to take on such a monumental task.
Yeah. And well, what was hard about it was because Peter was always moving and it was hard to he would dart away from you or what?
Peter was always moving. He was a serious behavior problem. He had rages. And even in the most normal and happiest of circumstances, you need a break from your toddler or your young child, you know. So that was very, very difficult. However, in the midst of it, maybe halfway through, something unexpected happened, which is that Peter stopped spitting on me and he stopped smearing feces on himself. And he started looking forward to our schedule and the things that we were doing together, even if it was helping unload a dishwasher. And I really describe it as that period when I fell in love with my son.
How long into this was that? He was 3 when you brought him, 3 and a half when you brought him home from Russia. So now we're
talking. It was 2 years later.
2 years later.
Two tough, battle-worn years.
Yeah. And how was he around your husband? At that point, the same? Was it similar?
It was similar. It wasn't as intense. I was doing this work. It's, you know, they asked the mothers to do this. It's the women these kids from these orphanages don't trust. It's the women that they abuse them. And it's the women that cause their neglect. And so it was important that I do this. Pat was there and helping and doing his best to keep Sophie occupied and feeling loved. Dr. Federici had asked us to take Sophie out of the home and send her to live with my sister, for instance, and we just refused to do that. I mean, she had needs, too. She had come from an orphanage as well. So it was an extremely busy, emotional time.
I'm eager to ask you about Peter and Sophie today, because today Peter is, what, 13 years old now, right? But before I do, I just want one last thing about fetal alcohol syndrome, which is the reason why you wrote the book. It kind of, in a way, surprises me that we don't know as much about it as we think we do, when all the warnings are to women who are pregnant is, you know, don't abuse alcohol. You know, prenatal alcohol is just not something you do. But you say that the general understanding of fetal alcohol syndrome and those that disorder is not well understood still?
I don't think it is well understood, and doctors are not consistent in their message to women. I have doctors who have counseled women in my own family that it's okay to have a glass of wine. And frankly, depending on your developing child's metabolism, depending on your metabolism, and depending on when you had that glass of wine, it's Russian roulette. It makes no sense to drink at all during pregnancy. Some women expose their children before they know they're pregnant in those first couple of weeks. Other women are more chronic drinkers and have a problem. But doctors don't like to ask women this when they come into the office. It gets shoved under the rug. And then when their children have problems and they go and get tested later on, they don't often, either because they don't have the knowledge that it could have caused damage or that there's a stigma attached to it. So they don't let the care, you know, the providers know, and these kids get diagnosed with autism.
And the stigma is you inflicted this on yourself and your baby.
Yes.
Right? All right. I want to ask you, I'm sure our listeners would like to know how Peter and Sophie are doing today and how they did in school, how you managed them through school, and where they are today. So first, Sophie, how is she doing today, and how did she manage through school?
Well, Sophie is doing pretty well. She is an active sixth grader. She's a talented artist, very talented, and a gifted athlete. She does have some residual stuff from being in an orphanage. She's got some emotional scars. She's got some learning issues that we're trying very hard to help her with. She goes to the Berry School in Silver Spring, which is a wonderful little Montessori school. Peter, when we moved here, had been in residential care.
In New York?
Yes, despite the progress that we had made with him through this boot camp process and everything else. Some of his mental health issues had become much more pronounced. He does have significant mental illness. He hallucinates. He hears and sees and feels things that aren't there. And at one point, his mental health deteriorated significantly, and he ended up in a psychiatric hospital and then in this wonderful residential school. You know, it broke our hearts. We never thought we would bring children home from an institution and put them in an institution.
Yeah.
However, it organized his brain in a way that we just weren't able to do ourselves. And they did him a tremendous amount of good. He is very stable now. When we moved to Maryland in July 2013, he was discharged from that facility, and he is home with us now, and he attends the Harbor School.
Tell us about that. That school is in Baltimore County in Owings Mills.
That's correct.
Tell us about that school, Mary.
Well, I can't say enough good things about that school. It is a special education school. Many of the kids are on the spectrum. They've had a fair share, the autism spectrum. They've had their fair share of kids with fetal alcohol. Quite a few Russian adoptees.
Really?
They know what they're doing. They know what these kids need. Peter is learning more, doing more, growing in a way that we never imagined he would. He's just really doing well right now.
When he's around you, what is it like when he's around you now?
Peter presents his challenges still. He's on a lot of medication. He can have meltdowns. He can have rages. But he is sweet. He is loving. He is connected to us. He trusts us.
Does he have conversations with you? How is his speech and articulation?
His speech in the last year and a half, I'd say, has blossomed. He's able now to tell us a lot of the things that set him off. And, of course, that makes everything better because we can help where before we didn't really know what the triggers were. And now he can say to us, you know, this bothers me or I can't take this. And that's been a tremendous help. And
what is Peter like when he's around Sophie?
He is like any typical sibling in many ways. They fight like cats and dogs one minute, and they are snuggled up on the couch looking at a book or talking about Pokemon the next. So in that way, it's pretty typical.
And how are you and Pat doing, your husband?
Well, we're coming up for air. Last summer, we went on vacation, which we haven't done.
Just the two of you? Or with
we're not
kids?
There yet.
Okay.
But we did take the kids to the beach and did some other things. And things are on the upswing.
Well, Mary Evelyn Green, it's been nice to have you on the show. Tell us your story. It's an amazing story, really. Congratulations for getting through it this far.
Well, thank you so much.
Continued progress with Peter and Sophie. When Rain Hurts is Mary Evelyn Green's book. She wrote a memoir about her experience adopting Peter from Russia, an adopted mother's journey with fetal alcohol syndrome. Part of the reason for writing the book is to bring more awareness to that syndrome. So thank you, Mary. And as far as Peter goes, you're going to go visit him or pick him up at school? Does he stay at that school, or does he come home to Montgomery County with you?
Well, he gets dismissed at 3, and mm-hmm. the bus brings him home.
Excellent.
So I probably will let him stay today for the rest of the school day.
Well, good luck.
Thank you so much, and thank you for this opportunity.
Sure. Thank you, Mary. Thank you, everybody, for tuning into our midday show today. Dan Rodericks for our staff here. And we'll see you again tomorrow in 22 hours, another edition of our midday show. Have a great afternoon.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producer is Michael Himowitz. Our interns are Carrie DeSantis, David Richman, and Marjorie Goodman. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Rodrick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.
This is your public radio, WYPR. Here and Now is next. Then stay with us at 3 for fresh air and at 4 o'clock for All Things Considered.
Anti-terrorism laws have all but blocked money transfers from Americans to Somalia. For tens of thousands of Somali Americans, that means no longer sending money to family back home.
It's money that they need to survive. There are no jobs, nothing. If they don't get this money, they will starve.
A financial pipeline dries up later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered, this afternoon from 4 until 6:30. Stay tuned at 6:30 for business news on Marketplace, and then tonight at 7 for The World. And be sure to join us tomorrow for Morning Edition.
If you missed Morning Edition this week, then you missed this surprising report from NPR's Shankar Vedantam.
In an analysis of more than 1,300 counties, the amount of anger expressed on Twitter is a very powerful predictor of heart disease in those counties.
Tune in tomorrow and don't miss out on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition. You can hear the show tomorrow from 5 till 10 a.m. It'll be followed tomorrow morning at 10 by Marilyn Morning with Sheila Cast. And coming our way this weekend.
Do you ever wonder about that moment when two people click?
I don't think that there's anything that really feels better than that.
In that moment, what exactly is it that clicks?
What clicks? And if we can know what clicks, can we learn how to make it click more?
This week on Radiolab, stories of soulmates, particles colliding, and the desperate search for symmetry.
Radio Lab. You can hear the show at 1 o'clock on Saturday afternoon right here on your public radio. Member support at 88.1 WYPR and WYPR HD1 Baltimore, WYPF Frederick, WYPO Ocean City, and online.